Good morning, everybody. Great to see you, and thank you for singing with us. If you are here today and you have, over the course of time, struggled with doubt in your faith, anybody remember a phase of time you struggled with doubt and having some severe doubts? I don't mean doubts like, you know, am I sure? I mean like really wrestling with doubt. And also, perhaps that leads to discouragement in your faith. And we know that there are plenty of people who go an even step further to start to deconstruct their faith. If you are someone who is doubting or has doubted, or you love somebody who is doubting or has doubted, or if you're really heavy-hearted for somebody deconstructing their faith, starting to dismantle the whole thing and really get beyond doubt to disbelief, I believe it's possible here that the God of heaven would like to weigh in on that, has something to say about that, and would like to approach you in his gentleness as you wrestle with doubts about Christianity. And maybe it's you just have some challenges on the intellectual side, past wounds, or you just find yourself being skeptical more and more. It makes sense that somebody can't or won't trust someone that they don't know very well. It makes sense that when Jesus says, I want you to come follow me, pick up your cross and come with me, that if you don't know who you're following, there's probably some hesitation. It makes sense. And so, on the contrary, a clear vision, a clear picture of who Jesus is leads you to awe. It leads you to worship. It leads you to obedience. A true vision, a true picture, a clear picture of who Jesus is leads you more boldly to follow and obey. And it is less likely to lead you to comfort and control. The tension that a lot of us face is that we find ourselves following Jesus into what we hope is moments of spiritual high and spiritual excitement or spiritual stimulation, but have a really difficult time when that turns to following Jesus into suffering or following Jesus into hardship. And we often, just by instinct on the one hand, and then on the other hand, by our cultural training, desire and long for what we really want most is to follow him into comfort or someone who just fits our expectations. You ever heard that phrase? If you read the Bible, it never challenges your worldview. It never challenges your decisions. It never challenges what you believe to be right and wrong. You aren't reading the Bible the way it's written. You are reading it. You are reading yourself into it. And Jesus says, follow me. I want you to come with me. This Christian faith is about following me. But it doesn't lead you to follow always. And it won't lead you to follow someone. If you're following Jesus, Jesus isn't saying, follow me to an earthly throne. You're going to be so thrilled with the results. I'm going to have a throne, and you're going to be princes and princesses, and you're going to kind of serve me, but also be elevated. And in fact, when Jesus says, follow me, it's hard for us to grasp that what he's saying is follow a suffering servant all the way to an executioner's cross. That's hard for us because most of us have no problem following a winner. I know that some of you are out there and the teams that you follow have recently won the Super Bowl. Kansas City Chiefs fans, I know you're out there. I know you're out there. And how many of you have kids who selected the team that's their favorite team because that's the most recent championship winner? I still remember the day that my youngest said he wasn't really sure he was a Yankee fan. He's probably a Toronto Blue Jays fan. And that was the day that we cut him off. That was the day. I hope he's doing well wherever he is. Well, most of us are attracted to the winning team. And Jesus, of course, it's hard for us to grasp that when he says, come follow me, that we're supposed to somehow get a picture that we're following someone who's going to be betrayed, rejected, and suffer, and ultimately get executed. It's a difficult picture in our mind. But Jesus is saying, but following me is going to cost you. It'll feel like your king has been defeated. It'll feel like your king is losing until the very, very end, when your king conquers once and for all and forever. To follow me, you'll end up carrying your own cross, not sitting on your own throne. And these are the reasons why when Jesus is calling his disciples and when Jesus is calling you and I to follow him, that it's not always easy to follow, because what we're expecting is a king who sits on an earthly throne just like the disciples. But what Jesus is saying is your king is going to suffer on a cross before he ever wears a crown. And that means I ask this question. Why would I ever follow Jesus again into this suffering, betrayal, rejection? Why would I do that again? And here's one of the main reasons in the Gospel of Mark that we decide to respond to Jesus' invitation, come follow me, and it's because of this, because of the radiance of Jesus. His radiance is why we follow. In Mark chapter 9, there's a mountaintop experience. You've heard that phrase before? I had a mountaintop experience. I was like right up on the mountain and it was glorious. You familiar with that phrase? And then in contrast, what's in contrast? A dark valley experience, right? Well, the disciples are about to have a mountaintop experience. And it's unforgettable. But it's going to come right after they failed in ministry to cast out demons Eventually, they're like, Jesus, some of those demons aren't coming out. What's the story? And he's like, well, those are different. And then explains that here's why you really kind of flopped there. And it's also going to come after ministry fears, because Jesus just said, I'm not always going to be with you. I'm going to be betrayed, and I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to be executed. So right after their fears and right after their failures, they're going to ascend to this mountaintop. And they're going to have an experience called the Transfiguration. And the Transfiguration compels us to see Jesus rightly, not just as a human teacher, but as a glorified Son of God. And we'll talk about specifically, how will I know if and when I see Jesus clearly? Because if we see Jesus clearly, we will increasingly trust him. If we see Jesus, we will increasingly follow him boldly. If we see Jesus clearly, we will increasingly worship him with our whole hearts. If we see Jesus clearly, if we see the radiance of Jesus, it compels us to live different, to follow him well. Look what the three disciples experienced with Jesus while they were following Jesus. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John. He just grabs three of them. And he led them up a high mountain to be alone. And as the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed, face changed. And his clothes became dazzling white, far whiter. I love this phrase by Mark. He's like, he became really, really white. And for those of you who are thinking it was like something that some kind of white that I wear around when I wear my white clothes, he's like way whiter. I know you've bleached some of your clothes and you've gotten them white, white. This is whiter than anything that could happen on earth. This is a white, dazzling white that comes from heaven. It's far whiter than any earthly bleach could ever make them. Then Elijah and Moses appear. Now, I want you to just stop for a second, because as you listen to this story, I want to put this out in front of you. Be careful not to allow this to just be a kid's story in a storybook that is almost fantasaical. Be careful that when you think of this, we're talking about a real historical figure, Jesus, in the flesh. Not just a storybook character, some religious leader that has been recorded over time, and now we have this fantasaical picture. But when you picture this, picture a real Jesus, historical person, and not even his critics, not even the godless question whether Jesus was a real man who was a literal human being who walked the face of the earth. And he grabs three of his disciples who are on record in so many different instances as being real people. And he says, we're going to go up to the mountain. And then this really happens. Really happens. Elijah and Moses appeared and began talking with Jesus. So this is incredible. Because it does kind of remind us of another mountaintop experience in the Old Testament where Moses is on Mount Sinai. And here we see Moses having a mountaintop experience very similar to what is being described here that Jesus has as Jesus radiates God's glory. Well, on Mount Sinai, God's glory appears as a consuming fire, and kind of a cloud to Moses. And Moses only gets to glimpse the back of God. And then you remember that causes his face to shine with what's called Shekinah glory after that encounter. And then the people notice that he's shining with this glory the way that we would notice the moon is reflecting the light of the sun. But here at the Transfiguration, Jesus' entire being shines with the divine radiance of the Creator of the universe. And Jesus isn't being described here as a prophet, but instead he's being portrayed as God himself. He's not a prophet speaking on behalf of God. He is literally God himself revealing himself. And this transformation is not a reflection. Rather, it's the radiation of his divine nature, not a reflection. He's the exact imprint, and we're seeing here the divine presence himself radiating glory that's emanating from within him because it's who he is. It's not how close he got to another source of light. He is not Moses reflecting. He is God himself radiating his dazzling white. His clothes became white, and that, of course, you can imagine symbolizes something. It symbolizes the righteousness of God himself, the purity of God himself. It symbolizes, of course, his sinlessness and his holiness all being radiating to project that they are witnessing, the disciples are watching God himself speak with Elijah and Moses. And I love the way John Owen puts it. He says, in Christ, we see the splendor of the eternal God. He is the brightness of the Father's glory. And this brightness is not borrowed and it's not fading, but his own eternal brilliance. And we have to picture this. This Jesus who's inviting you to follow him is not a version of a prophet. Is not a heavyweight teacher who's well thought of and well regarded and well recorded. Jesus, who's inviting you to follow him, is God himself, demonstrated and radiating his fullness here. Now, Moses, of course, on the mountain was the lawgiver, right? God appears to Moses and gives him the law. And now we see Elijah, the prophet, later on speaks of those laws and refers to God's revelation of himself and speaks on behalf of God. And you can see here that Jesus now is being linked to the Old Testament law represented by Moses and the Old Testament prophets represented by Elijah. And then we've got Jesus suggesting that the law and the prophets are fulfilled in Jesus' appearing. That the law and the prophets are now finally fulfilled by God himself. He's God's final revelation, and he's finished what Moses and Elijah have pointed to all along. Moses ascended to Mount Sinai to receive God's law and encounter his presence, and now Jesus ascends a high mountain as fulfillment of God's law as God's presence, and it's complete. final revelation. No more to come after this. We can have life-changing confidence in who Jesus is. Let me say that again. We get to, based on what's revealed in the Gospel of Mark, we can have life-changing confidence in who Jesus really is. We cannot reduce Jesus to another teacher, another religious leader, another guru, another spiritual father who's just inspiring or moral or is such a great example of morality. We have to accept that this is God, or we have to reject him entirely. So, what do we do now? Now, I've sprinkled a few of these what nows here along the way instead of at the end. So, we're not at the end, so you can relax, okay? Here's what we do now. Let his glory, who he is, the radiating glory of the Father in heaven, in his fullness in Jesus, let it stir your love and deepen your faith. Let it stir your love and deepen your faith. When you behold the glory of Jesus, over time, as you begin to absorb more and more of it to the degree in which we're able to do that in our own senses, it stirs love and it deepens faith. Jesus' radiant brightness now becomes our comfort in the darkness. It becomes our comfort in hardship. When the valley gets dark, we have a radiating Savior who said, by faith, you are in me. You belong to me. You are with me and in me. And he becomes an assurance to us when we're in trouble. So, you remember this phrase that was described to us, that we love Jesus because he first loved us. That's why we get to love him, because he first loved us. When you read, God so loved the world, he initiated that. When you read that God demonstrates his love for us, we should have this fortifying confidence deep within the frame of our being that these aren't just words, that these are made personal and real by the self-sacrificing actions of God himself, that he assures us and reassures us. These aren't just words. I love you. I want you to feel good. I want you to hear my words. I want you to be affirmed a bit. Those aren't words. These are actions when God himself lays his life down self-sacrificially to say, I'm demonstrating my love. It's not just words. It's action. And that brings this fortification to us deep down in our bones, that God did for you what you could never do for yourself. He rescued you in ways you could never rescue yourself. And that's exactly like the loving Father that he is. And all of this begins to stir this affection for Jesus, that my love gets stirred up and my faith gets deepened because I'm not just following a trendy prophet who one day will give way to another prophet, will go from Moses to Elijah to Jesus to whomever is next. So your response is appropriately all of my affection, 100%. All of my trust, 100%. That's my response. That's the reasonable response to what we're learning, that we can't have an encounter with Jesus, of course. If you follow along in the Gospels enough, you recognize this. Our disciples can't have an encounter with Jesus that doesn't end in them misfiring. Have you noticed that? There's some kind of way in which there's a misfire. Often it's Peter, and we're going to see this again. We're going to see a misconception of Jesus in this passage while they're here on the mountain, and Peter's going to lead the way in this misconception. Peter exclaims while he's watching this, right? Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. And when I picture this, I really shouldn't do this because I don't want to paint a picture about what's happening that's not accurate, but I can't help it. But I picture this. I picture Peter doesn't exactly know what to say, but he's watching Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And so they're talking, by the way. This doesn't say, when they finished talking, Peter said, they're talking, and here's Peter. It's really good that we're here. Together, all of us, it's really wonderful for us to be here. I mean, there's no record. Mark doesn't say, and then Jesus replied. Then he goes on, what we should do is just add this idea, hear me out. I'm going to make these three shelters and as memorials. And of course, we're going to do one for you, Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Now, you see why I don't want to portray that. Who knows if that's what it looked like. But Peter, this is why I think this might be what it's looked like, what it looks like. He said this because he didn't really know what else to say. For they were all terrified. So this is why I picture Peter just kind of being like, oh God, somebody should do something. Oh God, he's right there. Somebody should say something. Somebody should do something. What are we supposed to be doing? And it's always Peter. It's always Peter. So Peter thinks in his mind, we should do something that's going to please God. I know what we should do. Let's, Jesus, hear me out. This could be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I would like, perhaps you would love this. Three memorial, kind of we'll build this tent or a shelter, almost a tabernacle, and we'll have three of them. It'll be Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. And we'll never forget this moment. We'll always be able to come back here to the mountain and see. The God of the universe sent his law-giving, his prophet, his son right here on this mountaintop. That's the best thing I could think. And also, Jesus, we're all terrified. Please don't do that to us while we're here. And we see that by making these three, by having this idea of making three shelters, here's what we're going to discover. Can you imagine how surreal this was? Can you imagine how mind-boggling this was? But Peter doesn't really grasp that it would never be appropriate to have a memorial for Moses and Elijah and then the same one side by side by side for Jesus. They're not the same. One led to the next, and the next led to the full and final revelation of the Father. There will be no need to remember this moment because this isn't where following me stops. This is the mountaintop, Peter. This is not the valley of the shadow of death that I'm about to lead you all into. This is not where it stops. And here's where I see myself in Peter. I don't always know what's next, but I tend to forget that Jesus says, before this moment, I am going to be rejected. I am going to be betrayed. I am going to suffer, and I'm going to be executed. And on the way, we're going to have a real wild experience, but that's not the end. I'm eventually, and we're going to see this a little bit later, where Jesus reminds him again, Peter, this isn't where it stops. When you follow me, you don't stop at the mountain. I am going to lead you into terrible hardship and suffering. And you have to consider whether or not you're going to pick up that cross of yours and follow me all the way up onto the mountain for an unbelievable experience that you'll never forget. But we're not staying here, we're not stopping here, we're not pointing people here, because eventually I'm going to lead you right down to the cross, and that's where we're going to point people. This is where your life is going to change. Not remembering the mountaintop, but instead seeing my glory revealed in his fullness on the cross. God demonstrates his love for you in that while you were still sinners, Christ died for you. And going back to remember the good times, and some of us get so trapped. If you've been around a while and you've lived this life long enough, we want nothing more than to go back when it was glorious. We want to go back to where we perceived, I'm telling you that Moses was there and Elijah was there and Jesus makes a bit of an appearance there. It was so, so great back then. Be so careful. Church family, when you're following Jesus, be careful that you follow him all the way to where he wants to take you now and in the future, not just remembering how glorious it was in the past. And Peter, God bless him, doesn't even know what to say, except his heart tells him, stop right here. This is it. Jesus, in just a few verses later, says, Peter, I've already said this once. These are my words. I'm going to say it again. I must be betrayed and rejected. And I will suffer terrible shame and find myself up on that cross because I've willed to do it because the Father is revealing himself. And also, he's rescuing you. And we can't stay here. We've got to get there. We must get there. But Peter's overlooking that soon coming suffering. He's trying to remember the mountaintop. And of course, he forgets and ignores that Jesus had just revealed that his mission leads to his cross long before he's going to be wearing his crown. Like any human tries to grip the kingdom's benefits, of course, glory and power, while resisting the higher calling when you follow Jesus to embrace suffering and to embrace obedience. Jesus' response, of course, is not this. Peter, that is an absolutely terrific idea. I can picture it now. We could have some purple tent drapes. We could really get this thing. These three memorials could be awesome. We could sell shirts and sell mugs and keychains. We can overcharge people for gear, gadgets, and gizmos, and they could leave with souvenirs at this. Jesus, of course, says, no, the mountaintop is not our destination. I'm taking you somewhere more important. And then Jesus is going to go on to lead him down the mountain into the valley of the shadow of death. What's the main meaning? If you're following Jesus, here's what this means. Don't stop following Jesus at your mountaintop. We all kind of want this kind of Christianity that says it needs to always and forever be the thrill of the mountaintop. I mean, let's do this again. How many of you in your lifetime can think of times where you were really flourishing in your faith, knowing, following, adoring Jesus? You remember those times? Did you raise your hand? You could think of those times. You remember there were some major ups. Now, keep your hand up. Keep your hand up if before and after came some valleys, came some hardship. Can I tell you what that means? This is what it means. You're following Jesus rightly. This is what Jesus will do. He will lead you up. He's with you. He'll lead you down. He's with you. And, of course, he stays with you. When you desire comfort and you're craving the comforts, you'll find that Jesus will lead you into sacrifice. And John Stott, he points out we should be very, very careful of a Christianity that points to winning only. Very suspicious of a Christianity that says, if you want to win, you can win. Do you know how to win? Come with us. We're Christians. Doesn't always feel like winning. Sometimes, I'm sure that you've sensed this in the last several years, you look out on the world and you say, are we even competing? I mean, we're definitely not winning, but are we even in the game? Well, John Stott goes on to say, any Christianity, we should be leery of any Christianity that says, hey, we're going to be winning only, and it ignores self-sacrifice, and it somehow ignores suffering. But Jesus demonstrates that you'll always carry your own cross before you ever wear your own crown. You'll do it. That's the way it goes. And is there a way to be sure? Is there a way to be sure to be positive about Jesus' identity? Is there a way? Well, there is this confirmation of Jesus coming on the mountain. The three disciples there. And this is how it goes. Check this out. Then a cloud overshadowed them. Last thing we know, Peter's got an idea. Here's what we should do. Now, cut to this. Now there's a cloud that appears and overshadows them, and a voice from the cloud. Anyone remember a voice from the cloud? Right? Moses, the way God appeared and spoke to Moses, and says, this is my dearly loved son. Listen to him. You probably sense this, that very similar feeling here of God revealing himself and speaking on Mount Sinai to Moses. He does so when Moses is there all by himself. He speaks to him, his voice portrayed in a cloud and sometimes a pillar of fire. And here, this cloud overshadows them, and again, we hear God's voice being revealed. And God's voice is speaking very specifically to confirm and affirm the identity of Jesus. Can't mistake it. You can't misfire. God says, this Jesus is my dearly loved son, and listen to him. The Father's voice here also echoes, you remember when Jesus was baptized, right? There's a dove and then a voice from heaven that says, this is my son, whom I love. And we see again God himself coming through this cloud and his voice speaking. It's fascinating to consider what that voice might have sounded like. I would imagine it resonated deeply as the one who made you is speaking to you. And instead of giving the law and instructions for the tabernacle like the last time he appeared, God basically says, I've revealed myself in the law, I've reminded you of that in the prophets, and now my word is not going to be relayed to someone else, my word is with you. My word is present. My word is a person. And that word, my word, is my son. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. And here's God expressing who he is in Jesus, and he's saying, listen to him, emphasizing, of course, that Jesus himself now carries divine authority. And what he says can be interpreted as God's words himself. And also God's final revelation. I know that there is a massively popular category of books and media about God speaking or somebody appearing in heaven. And I want to consider this, that what you, and I've always wondered this, right? I've always wondered, well, I think I know why, that there's an appetite for new revelation. There's an appetite for, oh my goodness, did you read that book? So-and-so went to heaven and talked to God, and they had this conversation, and they wrote it down, and we get to read it. And this is how I think of it. I have to think of it this way. What more could I need to know about who God is than what he's always already revealed through the Word, who is Jesus? There's nothing more that's needed. The full and final revelation has already been given, and it is he himself, Jesus, who is the Word and the words of God. And the proper response is not just to remember him. The proper response is to obey him. If we believe that this is the dearly loved Son, then we obey him. We don't just remember him. We don't just point to him. We don't just refer to him. We don't just salute him. We don't just acknowledge him. Instead, this is what happens. Suddenly, when they looked around, Moses and Elias, you guys don't see that there, but I know the original language. Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus with them. They saw only Jesus. So here, in this transfiguration, we get the emphasis, we see this emphasis, that Jesus is not just another prophet, but who's the one who remains on the mountain? At Sinai, Moses brought the law. Here now, on this mountain, Jesus brings grace. His mission is to bear the judgment that that law demanded. And by Moses and Elijah disappearing, only Jesus is remaining, and that tells us that the old covenant now has been replaced, and this new covenant has now been introduced, that Jesus alone is the way to God, no more through satisfying the law and submitting to the prophets. Instead, Jesus alone is, in fact, the way to God. I want you to notice, too, and this is a little bit silly, but There's so many things that could have been written here. Mark could have said, listen to him. He could have recorded this, or God could have said out of this cloud, God could have said, this is my dearly loved son, listen to him, and also other religious teachers who are very wise. Listen to Muhammad. He's going to come along next, and he's going to say X, Y, and Z about this one true God. Or listen to Jesus, and also you're going to want to pay attention to Buddha. He's going to have some things that are going to help you kind of endure this life. He doesn't say listen to him, and also you're going to hear some really, really influential people. Lucifer used to be an angel. He's going to have some insights on how to enjoy your life. Nobody that we know is mentioned that we ought to give them our heart's trust in what they're saying. Nobody. Not Nietzsche back then. Some of the more well-known influencers that we have today. We have to be so alert that it is, specifically, vividly revealed. We listen to Jesus. That's how God planned it. We don't listen to and take all of our worldview from Joe Rogan. We don't take it from Brené Brown. We don't take it from who else? We don't take it from our favorite TikTok pastor, our favorite president. We don't take, this is, God says, listen to him. And why is that? Because eventually Moses and Elijah and everyone else goes away, and only Jesus remains. That's it. Him and him alone. Jesus is my final revelation. And if you want to know specifically what I think, and you want to know who I am, listen to him. There's a Puritan author who has done so much writing on this very topic. Stephen Charnock is his name, and here's what he says. The glory of Christ is the end of all revelation. This is why you get around a new religion and you're like, oh wow, after Jesus there was a prophet who received a message and wrote a book and then sold them. And then passed them out. Well, I don't need that, because Jesus is the full and final revelation. He goes on to say, the law and prophets were but shadows. Christ is the substance. They were but morning stars. Christ is the sun that puts them all out. This is why after the cloud lifts, only Jesus remains. He's the only one who must be followed, the only one who must be trusted. Even though you're facing affliction, it's through the affliction. And through the affliction, you'll discover that you need Jesus primarily. And he brings people, he brings words of truth, he brings everything you need, but you essentially only ever need Jesus alone. One of my favorite things I learned when I was young about leading a church and being in leadership is, I think it was J. Oswald Sanders who said, it's the sin of the clergy to cultivate a dependence upon oneself. In other words, the clergy may not be committing all the sins you see out in the world, but the clergy is no less a sinner by cultivating a need for oneself instead of saying, sorry, I'm going to be long gone. I mean, don't even put a plaque up. I want you to see only Jesus and savor only Jesus. So Jesus reveals his glory, and even in the coming darkness. Thomas Boston, theologian, says, before the suffering of Christ is revealed, his glory must first be seen, lest the disciples despair when the hour of affliction comes, right? So imagine this. When the hour of affliction comes, when Jesus is being betrayed and suffering, and when he's being crucified, they give up on Jesus if they're not sure who Jesus is. If they think Jesus is just leading another political revolution, the revolution dies. If he's just a very important teacher, the teacher just died. They'll read his books and read his writing and abandon the whole thing. But Instead, Jesus says, no. Instead, God says, no, this is literally my son. He is my plan. This is what I have planned for him. He's willing himself to follow the plan of the Father all the way to his affliction. That's when the disciples say, we can follow him because we know who he is. This isn't a temporary plan. So then, what do we do now? Be careful not to only acknowledge and admire Jesus and not listen and obey him. It's so easy and so tempting for you and I to give him a salute, to pepper his words into our life, to mix it in like anything else that we've been listening to or we've added to our life. Seeing Jesus rightly means recognizing him as the divine fulfillment of all of Scripture, to see him as literally the literal epicenter of God's plan for salvation and rescue and meaning and purpose in our lives. And while you're reading the Bible, I love what the Jesus Storybook Bible subtitle says, and while you're reading the Bible, you get to remember that while you're reading it, every story you read is whispering the name of Jesus. So don't just admire him from a distance. Center your life on him. Tune in to his words. And above all other voices, cherish those words. So maybe it's important to ask ourselves a question. Can I truly listen? Can I truly obey if I've cluttered my life with so many distractions? I'm so hyperactive religiously in all that I have on my calendar. I have endless motivational speakers that I'm filling my ears with. I have raging personal ambitions that capture my attention. And I'm a part of a warring political tribe and I can't let up. And it's difficult then to find time and space in our heart and on our calendars to listen and obey, and listen to and obey Jesus. Seeing Jesus for who he truly is means that we never treat him as just a religious figure to admire. Instead, we submit to him and surrender to him as a king to obey fully and finally. You have near you, if you grabbed the communion elements on your way, you have, if you need some, we have some back on those tables. If you wait just a minute or so, I think they'll be coming around in case you missed it. These elements go with a monthly remembrance that we do. And that remembrance was given to us by Jesus himself. And perhaps now is the right time for us to ask ourselves, while you're opening those elements, now might be the time to ask yourself, has my faith become routine? Am I just picking and choosing what Jesus says, that I kind of do these things and not those things, I submit to this but not that? I could have a deep reverent awe for Jesus. Am I still trying to make him meet my expectations? I could be listening to him and following him. Am I captivated by his glory? Or my eyes distracted and captured by temporary thrills and pleasures of this world? You've got those elements in your hand, and Jesus gave us these elements to bring us back to what he's done, who he is, and the price he paid to demonstrate his love. These are not routines and ceremonies for us to check a box and to happen to signal to God that we're still willing to do whatever. This is us observing. This is how God has expressed, I love you. Not just words, with my broken body and with my shed blood. And on that night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread, and he gave thanks to God for it. Would you take a second and just thank God for that bread before you receive it? Just thank God for it. Then he broke it in pieces and he said, this is my body which is given for you. Do this to remember me. Would you receive that symbol of the broken body if you haven't yet? In the same way, he took the cup of wine after supper, saying, this is a new covenant between God and his people, an agreement confirmed with my blood. Do this to remember me as often as you drink it. For every time you eat this bread and you drink this cup, you are announcing the Lord's death until he comes again. Would you receive that symbol of his shed blood, his, not ours? While we're singing, there's going to be some people who have willingly volunteered to pray for the church family. And they want to pray for you. And I want to invite you while we're singing to slip out of your seat and bring to them anything that you're carrying alone. That this is a time for the church family to say, if you have a burden, I'm going to help you lift it. If you care about it, I care about it. And we're going to put our faith together and we're going to lift these things that are on your heart. We're going to lift them to the Father in heaven. So as we, as we're singing, I want you to follow that impulse to say, I need God's intervention. And I need to put my faith together with someone who is going to pray a prayer of faith, expecting that God can intervene. Marriage, family, health, career, heart condition. God, would you help me to see you and obey you? Would you help me respond to you appropriately? I want to invite you to come. Would you stand? We're going to sing and pray and pray and sing. Sing and pray and pray and sing. And those of you who need prayer, just slip right out of your seats right now and we'll meet you right here in the front.